I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order. Committee, thank you for being here. We don't have an extremely long agenda, though the agenda might be a little deceiving when you look at it. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 4058. And with that, I'm going to invite up somebody to talk about 4058.
Somebody.
Aloma and Felisa, I guess. And specifically talking to us about the Dash 3 Amendment.
For the record, my name is Felisa Higgins. I'm the political director at SAU Local 49. If we could, I'll direct your attention to the Dash 3 Amendments because that's what we'll be discussing here today. And I'd just like to walk through these in a little bit of detail. First of all, I just want to start out with the original bill, which was passed last session, House Bill 3279. I think it's important that this bill didn't come through this committee, so it's sort of hard to flash back to what this bill functionally is about. And it really was a conversation related to the janitorial industry and the rampant sexual assault and harassment that has been taking place in the industry. In fact, this last weekend, I was just with a group of workers, and another worker came forward from our union, and the discussions that we continue to have, like they are normal discussions, of whether we are going to refer rape victims to Kaiser, where their health insurance is, or to Multnomah County because they provide better trauma-informed services. So just to set to have us in the setting of what this bill is functionally about, it's about protecting workers from assault on their jobs. And so if you look at page 15, line 18 through 24, this is really the most important piece of this piece of legislation. And we've agreed to make changes to the training to make it really possible for these to be real, effective, and detailed trainings so that the rules are clear and they should be adjusted for QRFs so people that the trainings are adjusted for people's ability, which is in the rulemaking, and so that in the outline, the trainings have to be performed in the first 90 days of employment so that you get the training right away when you get hired. And then every 2 years, a refresher. And our hope is, in talking with the EEOC, is that they have seen as changes to those trainings to make them more and more effective over time. And so we already have a commitment to work with the EEOC on making sure those trainings evolve and that we're getting data back from them. If we could move backwards to page 4, we've had a discussion with the Oregon Rehabilitation Association and others regarding the entity versus registration of individuals. There's a very big difference in janitorial companies than there is in farm, forestry, and construction. And janitorial companies are much more focused on the entity with individual stakeholders as opposed to in farm labor and construction, it's much more tied to the individual. And so we wanted to make that clear as part of this registry that we're really talking about entities. They have in janitorial, we have a more permanent and less seasonal workforce, and they have permanent employees who do recruitment and retention, and they recruit and retain workers in a much more traditional manner. So they run newspaper ads. They do word of mouth, just like any employer who's looking for good workers nowadays. They post on sites like Craigslist and Idealist to recruit. That's much more traditional than how recruitment happens in farm and forestry and construction. And so we wanted to work with the ORA and other stakeholders to make that change, to make that clear in the statute. And that's on page 4. The next piece is the inclusion of nonprofits. So there are historical reasons why in farm and forestry nonprofit entities have not been included and had a 5-year ban on entering the market. They've had a lot of trouble with nonprofits entering the market and sort of basically breaking the law. We don't feel this way in janitorial. We actually feel like it's important from the first day a nonprofit decides they want to go into the janitorial industry and cleaning industry, we want them to be registered and become part of that legitimate community. And so we want to lift that ban for the property services contractor. Currently, we have many nonprofits actually operating in janitorial services. And then there was a TBW, Tualatin Valley, was here last week feels like a long time ago, but it was just last week, discussing the qualified rehabilitation facilities. All 22 qualified rehabilitation facilities in our state are currently able to be licensed, and there are reasons why. There are legal reasons and some other reasons outside of this bill that other QRFs may not come forward and be registered or start janitorial cleaning companies. All 22 are currently registered, but we welcome other nonprofits into entering the industry, especially legitimate folks who want to be part of the community cleaning and janitorial and register. So we wanted to make sure to lift that ban. Second, on page 8, lines 2 through 8, we want to make sure that since we're licensing entities, that those who are financially responsible for that entity are listed on the application. So janitorial is a low barrier to entry if you work with these types of contractors. What we wanted to make sure is those folks are listed, so you can't be Bob's Cleaning on Monday, get your license revoked as Bob's Cleaning, and on Thursday be Robert's Cleaning and get a new license. So having that list helps us make sure that those who are financially responsible are listed, they know the rules, they've agreed to be property services contractors. We feel like this amendment does that and maintains the licensing of the entity. I also just want to point out here, however, in farm labor and construction, it also limits personal information that Bully can ask for from those individuals who are financially responsible. In farm labor and construction, that individual versus entity is a much blurrier line. So you may be an individual recruiter who sort of has your own recruitment business that you're then recruiting for a grower. And so we felt like it was really important to clarify for the industry that we are talking about and that we know the most about. Page 9, lines 3 through 7 is the next portion. This really is to address the exam question as part of this. So you, to become a labor contractor, you have to take an exam that basically certifies that you know the knowledge of what it means to be a labor contractor. We wanted to make sure that Bully gives people who want to become labor contractors maximum flexibility in how they'll take that exam. That we wanted to make sure that they could, Bully would allow people to take it online. If there was an online choice, you can come and take it in person if that's the best way that works for you. Maybe it could be part of the application. And so just encouraging Bully to have more flexibility with property services contractors, especially given the volume and the size of the number of property services contractors there are out there. The next piece is page 17. Line 23 and page 18, line 19 through 14. This is the issue around certified payroll that the gentleman from Tualatin Valley spoke to last time he was here, and submitting payroll every 35 days. We feel the volume in property services, there's no need to submit payroll every 35 days in the property services contractors because, as I said before, they're less seasonal workers, more established contractors. You typically have the same employers or sort of operators in the industry for longer periods of time. Managers are less seasonal. There's a federal law that says you have to maintain payroll records for 3 years. And the employee and Bully should be able to request those records at any time. And so we clarified that piece in the language here, but you'll see that. And so that addresses the issue of the paperwork that it would take and the personnel that it would take to submit those records every 35 days when it comes to property services contractors. The time to implement without penalty, so page 20. Lines 20 through 30. So I think the really important thing here is on the time to implement. We heard from ORA and other folks that they had a concern about the civil penalties that can be accrued with under the bill right now and getting people up to speed. We sent a joint letter to Bully actually in December asking for them to give a time period before penalties can be start accruing since the implementation of the legislation. They agreed to that and then pointed out that we would need to waive the civil penalties in the current statute. So that's what you have in front of you today. And it just allows for time. We agree that in an industry that it's a brand new registry, people are just getting up to speed. It's an industry that has had a lot of problems, frankly. And our hope actually is this legislation will clarify the people who want to be legitimate business owners, who really are in this to grow their businesses and have a responsible ownership, will register, they'll do the right things, and we'll get a handle on that. So that's why we've agreed to the 180 days. There are two things that I think are really important that we've been having a discussion about. One is people who clean individual homes. Our intent is for people who clean commercial spaces. I believe the legislative intent was for people who clean commercial spaces. This was not a bill that was meant to sweep up housekeepers who clean individual homes. I think the issue is the NAICS code is what Boley used to define the what applies under janitorial. They have the ability to adjust the NAICS code in rule, and so we'll be looking for direction from you all to make sure that they move forward with the adjustments in the NAICS code to focus on the industry that we're talking about, which is commercial janitorial. We don't need to have that in the legislation, but just a clarification from as part of the legislative intent. Also, we wanted to make sure that we get on the record that Boley will need to update the rules around the individual versus the entity. Like I said, we want to make sure that it's really clear that Bob's janitorial on Monday can't be Robert's janitorial on Thursday. And so there are just some slight rules changes that Boley needs to make. Overall, I would just want to thank the members of this committee and the members of the House Judiciary Committee, Senate Judiciary Committee, who have worked on this bill, and ORA, the Oregon Law Center, the Northwest Workers Justice Project, and others who've come to the table. For us, talking with our members and having talked with more than, I'm in the double digit victim conversations right now. And that has been personally challenging for me, I will say. But I also think it just proves that this has been a long time coming, and I really appreciate everyone's work to make this a functional bill that really, I hope, will protect workers into the future and at least educate them about what to do and when to come forward and how to come forward. I think it will make a dramatic difference in this industry. So thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Paloma Sparks with the Oregon Resource Association. I want to thank SEIU and Felisa for working with us on getting some of these changes in place. I think we all agree that the training requirement is valuable, and we want to make sure that our workforce is trained about what their rights are and what their responsibilities are, and how to seek help. And how, what their options are. So we remain committed to that, and we have agreed to that and have always remained steady on that point. So all of the things that Felisa mentioned, those were some of our suggestions, our wants to make this a little bit easier for employers to implement. An additional piece that was something that we wanted, and we heard from some legislators that they had constituents that wanted, is Boley requires that if you're using a vehicle to transport workers, you provide proof of insurance to Boley for that. But they were requiring that the business make Boley a certificate holder on the insurance policy. So we've asked to allow them to self-certify, which means that they would have to provide the policy number, ensure that it's within the policy limits that are required, all that sort of information, but they wouldn't have to make the agency an actual certificate holder. This conversation started mostly because I don't think anybody really realized in the implementation of or the passage of House Bill 3279 that nonprofits were sort of limited in their licensing under the labor contractor statutes. I think we fixed that. We fixed a number of other things that have been concerning to our members. And we're really thankful for all of your work and all of SEIU's work on this.
Thank you. Questions, Margaret Doherty?
Okay, I just want to go through and double check, and I'll be glad to help, you know, work with you. And it's the idea with Bully adjusting the whatever the standards they use for housekeepers, for
yes.
clean house cleaners. And so, I'll, you know, we want to make sure that that gets fixed. And then along with that, and this, I guess it would be the question for Bully, or I'll explain it, is that the housekeepers, the house cleaners that were informed that they had to do all of these things by January 1, when we get this resolved, hopefully that will be the second part, that they'll be notified that they no longer have to do all of this, because I at least from what I understand from my folks, is that they've not been notified.
Representative Holby, Representative Doherty, I believe Bully is taking questions and has several pending applications, and so it's hard for Bully to notify people with the bill still pending. And so I think our hope is that this will move swiftly through the House. The Senate has an emergency clause, and we can move directly into rulemaking at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And we've also been in contact with Bully and the staff person who has been leading on the rulemaking to begin, I think, hopefully swift implementation.
Okay, thank you for all your help. I appreciate it.
So am I hearing correctly that there's really nothing in the bill that indicates that we want Bully to treat housekeepers differently?
Representative Holby, we believe that after talking with the person who did the rulemaking the first round and looking at the definition that was in House Bill 3279, actually all we need was a clarification of legislative intent. And by going through this hearing and you saying that, Representative Doherty raising it on the record as issues, we're ready to move forward with that and a change in rulemaking. As soon as we pass this bill, they will reopen rulemaking.
Okay. I'm putting my faith in that rulemaking then, and hoping that it gets done right and doesn't come back to us to fix it yet again. That's my only concern, that we don't really say anything about that in the bill. But if we put it on the record, you know, hopefully, you know, they'll pay attention to that. And all right, thank you. Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you for all your hard work on this. I know we're really in the details, but I want to sort of pull up and say, you know, 3279 from last session was a really important bill about protecting workers in this industry. So thank you for your work.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions from the committee? Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Committee, if there's no objections, I'd like to go ahead and adopt the amendment, but I'm not going to move the bill right away. So if that is, we'll find out, I guess. Representative Beretta, would you care to make a motion on the -3 amendment on House Bill 4058?
Chair Holby, let's see, how's this going? Chair Holby,
I move to adopt the
-3 amendments to House Bill 4058.
Very good. Representative Barreto moves to adopt the -3 amendment to House Bill 4058. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the -3 amendment is adopted. And with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 4058. And My apologies to many in the audience. I thought maybe I would go through and clarify what we're doing here tonight. Before we have a hearing on House Bill 4159, we are going to carry over House Bill 4093. We will carry over House Bill 4046. We will carry over House Bill 4112. We will carry over House Bill 4115. And we are carrying over House Bill 4058, if I didn't say it already. We will carry over House Bill 4086. We will carry over House Bill 4113. We will carry over House Bill 4127. We will carry over House Bill 4147. And we'll carry over House Bill 4154. leave a lot left. With that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 40-122. Can I just carry over everything?
No. Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 4122, you heard at 3 o'clock. This is the measure that deals with the police officers who work for Oregon Health and Science University, allowing them to change the retirement plan that they're in. There are some people who are in the alternative retirement plan, and this would allow them to elect to be in the PERS system going forward from that data, from that change. There's no amendment on the measure. There's no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact, and this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Be in discussion on this.
Well, certainly want to stand at ease for a moment.
Yeah.
We'll stand at ease for a moment.
Thank you. So today we
reconvene the House Committee on Business and Labor, and we I will reopen the work session on House Bill 4122.
Robey, I move House Bill 4122 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Barreto moves House Bill 4122 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by subsequent reference. Discussion. Jessica, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Bowles?
Yes.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Penemar?
Excuse.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 4122 has passed to the Committee on Ways and Means. Got one off the table. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 4122. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 4159.
We'll make it.
Okay. Jan, would you like to describe House Bill 4159?
I want to, yes. Mr. Chair, committee members. This measure, it's the first time it's been before the committee. It directs the PERS board to adopt rules that allow members to choose how their individual account program, that's the IAP, to choose how it's invested among available options, declares an emergency. The Dash 1 amendment before you modifies language regarding the rulemaking that PERS will do to implement this measure. Requires the state treasurer's office to review the legal and fiduciary standards that's applicable to its office and the Oregon Investment Council with regard to the annual election by the members to change their investment. And finally, it requires state treasurer to notify the PERS board by December 31 of this year if there are legal and fiduciary standards prohibiting implementation.
Thank you, and we have Corey Snively, John Abel, and Steve Demarest.
I'll come in from the end here. Yeah.
Good evening. If you would just introduce yourself before you give your testimony, and whoever starts speaking first can go first.
I'll start. Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Steve Demarest. I am the president of SEIA Local 503. SEIA Local 503 is a union of nearly 65,000 Oregonians doing more than 500 different jobs in 85 state, local government, and nonprofit agencies, and in homes and care facilities. I also serve as a member of the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Board. I'm here today to testify as president of SAU 503 in support of HB 4159 and the proposed amendment. A little background on why this bill is needed. In September 2017, the Oregon Investment Council adopted a new investment policy effective January 1, 2018, to shift IAP member account investments to a custom target date fund, a TDF model, where the account's investment allocation is based on the member's age and anticipated retirement date. The shift to a TDF model is intended to reduce investment risk and volatility as members move toward a presumed retirement age. The strategy is to maximize the potential for account growth in a member's younger years when the member presumably has time to recover from occasional downturns in the market. As members move toward their presumed retirement age, the investment strategy gradually evolves to a more conservative allocation that will reduce the probability of large losses or large gains from market fluctuations. We agree that this is good, sound fiscal policy in general. However, it is important to recognize that many members do not fit the assumed trajectory of retirement. There are a variety of reasons for this, including coming to the public workforce later in their career or simply choosing to retire beyond 65 years of age. A worker may not want to reduce their investment risk as they near the age of 65, or they may want to be more conservative than the default TDF. Additionally, PERS OPSERP, the so-called Tier 3, is not, in most cases, adequate to support retirement on its own. So many OPSERP and other PERS members make their own private investments to plan for retirement in addition to PERS. Don't forget that the majority of the current workforce is made up of OPSERP members. Now, many of those members and other PERS members have made private investment decisions based on the 15-year investment history of IAP assets. This change is disruptive to the long-term retirement planning of those members. The current TDF model also treats each PERS member as an economic unit when, in fact, many PERS members, along with their spouses and domestic partners, are part of a two-person economic unit that may have a different set of priorities and circumstances than what is assumed for an individual member based on their age. And finally, I note that the current TDF model does not entirely escape the risk of volatility. A significant loss in a TDF may occur just before a member graduates to a more conservative fund, locking in the loss. The member may wish to pursue another investment strategy to meet a goal of retirement date and income. HB 4159 simply allows members to exercise some discretion over their IAP account, allowing them to direct that their account be invested in a TDF other than the one assigned by a birth year, or even choose to opt out of TDFs entirely and have them be included in the general OPERF. If a member does nothing, they will still be assigned a default TDF based on target retirement age of 65. HB 4159 will also allow PERS to move quickly to contract with a private vendor to manage the back-end member account details. PERS needs some flexibility in order to meet the January 1, 2019 timeline we're asking them to meet. The Treasurer's Office has asked for some amendments to clarify a few points, and we are fine with those amendments. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
You get questions first, right? You get questions first.
Oh, no, I think they take testimony first.
Yes, okay. I talked about the dashboard.
Chair Holby.
Go ahead, introduce yourself.
Chair Holby and members of the Business Labor Committee. My name is John Abel. I'm a business teacher at North Salem High School. I'm here to speak in favor of this bill as well. I've taught for 34 years, and along with some investments I have of my own, PERS and the IAP account, fairly significant portion of my portfolio. It's interesting. I would agree with many of what he said in that not all of us are the same. I'd like to applaud the Treasury Department and the Oregon Investment Council for being proactive and moving this way to mitigate some risk in setting up these target date funds. However, not all of us are in the same boat. As you said, some of them are starting later in life. Some of us have made our plans based on what PERS used to be at 8%, and now it's 7.5 and 7 and so on. We understand the picture of PERS. So as that becomes more and more conservative, I'd like my IAP account to become a little bit more aggressive to pick up some of the slack, because as I'm getting closer to retirement, I have a shorter window to do that. If the IEP puts me in the older class, then it becomes more conservative, and all of my money is now in a conservative investment. I'm getting a guaranteed rate of 7.2, plus my IEP now is in a conservative model. I like the options that they have, and I really applaud your committee and like to see this bill move forward.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much, Representative Holvig, for allowing us to share our personal stories. I'm here as a case study, and my name is Corey Snively. I'm a mathematics teacher, a financial teacher at North Salem High School. I've been teaching for 33 years. I'm 57 years old, and I plan on retiring in about 5-7 years, along with my wife at the same time. I enjoy teaching, and I continue to plan on doing so. Now, a case study for me. This is my presentation is more of a case study. As soon as I started employment as a teacher, I started investing. I have 403Bs for both my wife and I. In addition to that, I have Roths, and I have tax accounts also. I'm one of the fortunate few that my wife and I are part of a trust where we have a family trust. We have 1,000 acres of manageable timber, and so I'm probably one of the higher end folks that have other investments. PERS is just really a supplemental along with my AP. And based upon my age, I'm a little bit worried that my age is going to be a dictate me with my investment strategy. I've been handling my own investments for a long time, and I've been very successful with them. And my rates of return have been much higher than what I've received from the state. Now, my concern is that with this IAP fund, my return rate will now be delegated to a conservative allocation, whereas I've been investing what I would consider as growth at about 25 to 30%. I have accounts varying at different rates. My concern is that being able to pencil people like myself into this conservative allocation isn't appropriate. My ultimate goal is with my PERS and my IEP is to set that aside for my kids. And so I'm looking at that as a growth model so that as they become, or as my wife and I pass, they can have a, you know, that income that we've set aside. And so I'm looking at that perspective much differently than probably the majority. Now, I've been involved since October, contacting the Treasury Department, PERS, I've talked to the Executive Board members, I've been on the phone constantly, and I'm really happy that they came out, the Investment Council came out with the idea of target dated funds. Is a solid idea, but it's not a one size fits all based upon age. And so I really think that if you go in the private sector, you manage your money based upon your goals and basically on your income and so forth. And so I kind of look at that also as a public sector too. Since the Oregon Investment Council has opened up target dated funds, we have these 9 buckets. Being able to place yourself in the appropriate allocation for your financial situation, I think, is a good idea, and I hope that you can support that cause. Thank you very much, and thank you for hearing what I had to say.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Question for any of you here. I'm not familiar exactly how the PERS board works or how responsive they are. But I guess my question is, you felt you needed to command this through statute rather than working through the PERS board?
Yes. The understanding is that they felt this needed to be authorized by statute in order for the PERS board then to carry out rules to implement it.
Seemed like reasonable tweaks to make.
I was told this summer when I made phone calls that according to statute, we are not allowed to make investments, but only the Oregon Council can make investments. So if they gave us the choice to opt out or what this provision allows us to pick different target date, that would be illegal because then we're making our own investment decisions, which is currently not it's against statute.
And that's the same information I got. I've been involved with PERS and also the Treasury Department, so forth.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So these risk categories haven't been available before and still aren't. Is that what this does, is set up the different levels of risk for you to invest into? I mean, just like any 401k?
They weren't available before January 1st of this year. They went into effect January 1st. The current statute did allow OIC to unilaterally make that change in how they handle their investments, and they did so.
And I know the PERS board is still here, or representatives of the PERS board are here. If you want to ask them specifically any of the questions. Not seeing any other questions.
Pretty simple.
I think it's a good idea to be able to, you know, manage your money, especially given the officer not being able to survive on just that retirement. They have other investments, so it seems like you should have some ability to pick and choose how you want that invested, how aggressive you want it.
So. Can I ask one clarifying question?
Sure.
And so when you're talking about that, where you can choose whether it's risk, high risk, low risk, that's with the 6% that is the employee's contribution?
Correct. That's the money
so
we're talking
about. So it's the
employee
contribution.
Yeah. Since 2003.
Yeah,
correct.
It's your money. Yeah. Thank
All
you.
All right. I don't see any other questions, gentlemen. Thank you for explaining the bill before us, and hope you have a good evening.
Thank you, committee members.
Thank you very much, and you have a good evening. Thanks for hearing us.
Thank you.
So I don't know, Marjorie or Steve, do you have anything to add to this topic? I don't know that we have a specific question for you. How difficult will this be to do?
Thank you, Chair Holvey, and members of the committee. For the record, Steve Roman, Executive Director at PERS. There is language in the bill granting us expedited authority to put this administrative structure in place. And that, if I may, I'd just like to speak to that briefly. Back in 2003, when OPSERP and AIP were created and we were given some 4 months in which to build this new programming, this same language was used. So what it does is allow the agency to move expeditiously to set up the administrative structure that it's going to take to support this. As to how difficult it will be to do that, given this broad authority, I don't think it would be impossible. If we had to work through the normal RFP process and procurement process that the state normally demands for any kind of a public contract, I don't know how we would get all that done in enough time to educate and then collect the elections that members are going to have to make as to which target date fund they would like to be in. So that expedited authority is in the bill to allow us to work with our partners that we already have in place, or better ones if we can find them, that would take those administrative challenges on with us.
And questions, Representative Barreto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are there just going to be a limited number of pools then that they can choose from? Okay.
Yeah, Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, members of the committee, the target date funds themselves, there's 10 of them, and the member can choose among those funds. We handed out a one-pager, and you see this very colorful chart that shows you the mix of investments depending on what target date fund you want to land in. So that will be the extent of their options. Pick one of those 10 or opt out of target date entirely and just stay broadly invested in the PERS fund.
Thank you.
Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So since I sit on the General Government Ways and Means Subcommittee, we hear a lot about technology in the state of Oregon. And one of the things I've learned to ask is even things that sound like very simple changes to our technology systems and our software sometimes end up being very complicated. So I wondered if you could comment on how difficult this will be from a technology perspective to have people, members on it.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, Representative Fahey, thank you for the question. And you'll hear more about it when we appear in front of the General Government Subcommittee. But that has been in our brains as we have talked about the possibility of this bill. There are two hurdles that are going to be difficult to overcome, technology aside. One is, how do we capture the election of 250,000 individuals? How do we physically allow them to inform us of the choice? That's a technology solution that exists among any defined contribution plan, and we work with administrators who have those tools available. We just need to make them customize the tool, the face, to look like PERS. And so I don't think that technological hurdle is that hard. Integrating that into our systems, having access to that are all the kinds of solutions we already think we can have. The other thing that is a challenge is educating 250,000 members that they have a choice and which choice is best for them. That is one that that is not a technology challenge. That's simply a licensing challenge. We need to have access, our members need to have access to investment advisors that can go through their individual situation and make the right choice for them if they want to get educated about that. Again, a third-party administrator, such as the ones we work with on the Oregon Savings Growth Plan or the IEP, have those staff available to do that. So that's why the partnership is so important to answer your question. I don't think there's a technology challenge for us as much as there is a procurement challenge to get the right partner working with us. Down the line, as you've heard Representative Fahey in so many presentations to your committee, down the line, we want to look at the whole administrative model of the individual account program and whether and how we can eliminate any outsourcing of that program. This requirement moves that out a little further because of some of those elements that we're going to need to resolve and bring in-house. But again, with the right partner, our focus always is how do we improve the members' engagement with us? How do we satisfy the members' needs with us? We want to have a good partner to help us with that and then take our time to solve the technology challenges in a bigger context than just what this bill might present.
Just a quick follow-up. So, you're not going to come back to the subcommittee in a year and say the legislature asked you to do something that the software doesn't do, and so you need $2 million to. Does your software do this? I guess that's a nicer way to say it.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Representative Fahey, I'll tell you right now, it doesn't do this.
Okay.
We do not have any sort of a system by which members can go in, make an election such as this, have that election captured, recorded, and effectuated through our financial management processes. We don't do that now, so we have no way to support it. My point is more, given the time frames of this and given what people already do, better to go, you know, use a tool that's already out there than try to build it on our own.
This seems very similar to the Oregon Growth Savings Plan. Don't you get an opportunity to choose different target funds with that?
It is, Chair Holvey. That's exactly the point. We have a third-party provider, Voya, who manages the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. We have a very small staff in Salem that works on that program. Most of it is supported by this third-party administrator.
Oh, I see.
And it's the same sort of model we would look to replicate if that administrator is a willing partner.
Yeah,
we hope that they will be. Obviously,
well, on the consumer's end, it seems very simple. So,
yeah,
and easy to do.
Right.
Well, thank you very much. I don't see any other questions. Thank you for being here too. I appreciate you've been hanging out with our committee all day, it seems. we'll put an end to that soon.
I don't have to live in your backyard.
Yeah, right. So, with that, I'm going to close the. Was there anybody else that wanted to testify on? House Bill 4159. Seeing none, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 4159, and we will carry over the work session on House Bill 4159. And before I jump to any conclusions, I want to make sure I addressed everything.
You carried over everything except that bill, which you then passed out.
Right.
And then you just carried over this bill. Everything else had already been carried over.
Alrighty.
It would have been easier to just say, we're just going to do these two.
Yeah. Well, with that, committee will be back on Wednesday. I'm hoping we'll get through our business on Wednesday afternoon. Though there could be a short evening in our future as well. So with that, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.